You're listening to Living Lightly on the Land, an audio magazine of rural wisdom from your friends and neighbors at Cornell Cooperative Extension.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Living Lightly on the Land. I'm Liz Lo-Judas, your host. Living Lightly on the Land is brought to you by Cornell Cooperative Extension's Agroforestry Resource Center and is a monthly magazine about agriculture, forestry, and sustainability issues that are facing our communities. People who are concerned about sustainable communities are often dismayed by the amount of energy that is consumed in growing meat animals. Many meat animals spend part of their lives eating a diet of grain in contained feeding operations. Today's show will focus on a different approach to raising meat animals, grass-fed and pastured livestock farming. In pastured operations, ruminant animals eat their natural diet of grass, which can be harvested with far less energy than grain. This show features interviews with farmers and extension agents on the benefits of pastured meats. We'll start with an interview with Mick Basir, a pasture specialist at Cornell Cooperative Extension.
I'm here with Mick Basir, Cornell Cooperative Extension Ag Agent, and we're going to talk a bit about grass-fed meats.
Grass-fed meat is grass-based livestock production, wherein the primary feed is grass or forage products. There are several different categories of grass-fed, one of them being that some grain is incorporated in their diet at the end of their feeding period, and some where there is no grain, absolutely no grain in the diet at all the way through their lives is on grass. The American Grass-Fed Association is one of those people, one of these organizations that have standards and certification where there is no grass or no grain at all fed to the animals, but only grass. In the operations where there's, we talk about poultry and pork being pastured as well, predominantly they're on pasture and they're eating a great portion of it, of their diet is grass, but they're simple-stomached animals and have a problem eating strictly grass. So they need some of the energy that grain provides to make them into usable meat for our products.
You said simple-stomached animals. Can you explain the difference between simple stomachs and more complex stomachs?
Well, we like to talk about people having simple stomachs. Of course, you know, some people have upset stomach and they have issues with that. But simple stomach is one stomach where all the digestion takes place. In ruminant animals, which can utilize grass as their sole food source, they have four compartments which break down the grass and forage into usable energy for the animal's sustenance.
Mick, what are the benefits of our grass-based livestock operations for the land, the farmer, and the eater?
It's good for all the steps in the food chain, from the soil to the end product that's being presented to the folks on their plates. Grass-fed, exclusively grass-fed, particularly in the beef and the lamb and the goat, that sort of thing, are higher in some of the nutrients that we frequently hear the nutritionists brag about as far as what you need to be healthy and live a long and sustainable life, happy and vital all the way through. That includes generally higher vitamin E, vitamin A, the conjugated linoleic acid, omega-3 acids, which are being recommended by most nutritionists as coming from the fish and upping the fish portion of your diet. In this case, the grass-fed beef or lamb or goat meat would have same benefits as the fish without the worries of PCBs and mercury and that sort of thing. So it's actually a health food in its own right, and people are finally viewing it as such. The chickens and the pork are also higher in vitamin E and A and some of the omega acids, is particularly omega-3 acid in the eggs and pork. But like I said earlier, they're still on a grain ration diet, so their percentages are not as high as what the grazing animals or the ruminant animals with the four stomachs are going to be. Now, as far as sustainability, we figure that all the grain-fed operations are generally based on petroleum and iron being in the fields and a lot of intensive energy use and that sort of thing, whereas the livestock harvesting the grass, they have four-wheel drive and they have four stomachs and their necks reach all the way to the ground, so they're harvesting the product and turning it into useful food for our food chain. It's just more sustainable in that regard. And the soils, if you're in a good rotation and your pastures are managed properly, the soils are going to be better soils, have more life within them, and be able to sustain themselves if you have a good managed pasturing project. We've talked about the soil and the consumer being influenced positively by the grass-fed meat, but also the animals themselves, while they're on the pastures, are generally more healthy. In most cases, will have fewer parasites and will need to be treated less often for any of the illnesses that normally are found in confinement operations. In the case of milking cows, the milk also carries the high omega-3s and conjugated linoleic acid also, and they will end up treating pastured dairy cattle a lot less for mastitis and metritis issues, so that there be less use of any antibiotics or any other kind of synthetic chemical inputs. On top of everything else, in the animals that are being used for breeding and for milking and genetic transplant, their lives will be longer and richer, and they'll be healthier throughout their lives. So their useful life is actually longer on grass-fed animals than it is on animals that are confined and fed.
And then often I think about grass-fed based livestock operations as being good for the sustainability of our landscape overall, because if we have large areas in pasture, perhaps less likely to convert to a developed landscape. Is there any evidence towards that?
Yes, there is. It's the sustainability of the open landscape being used in, particularly in grass-fed livestock production and marketing, actually brings in more for the amount of inputs spent on your operations. So your profitability will be higher. Therefore, you can stay there and afford to be on the land and actually be in the business. Whereas a lot of the conventional agricultural enterprises are leverage to the hilt, and the profit margin is very low. So that one in itself is just the fact that it has an opportunity to be a higher margin industry than regular conventional or traditional agriculture, gives you the opportunity to be on the land and be able to enjoy paying your taxes.
Mick, as part of your job, you write grazing plans for farms. Can you explain what a grazing plan is?
Well, a grazing plan in general is where you manage your property to get the most grazing for the animals by rotating generally. The plans that I do are NRCS sanctioned and approved, prescribed management grazing, or MIG as it's called, a managed intensive grazing. Therein, you have a certain size of pasture and you have a certain number of animals, and you have to make them match up so that you're not overgrazing or having grass in too much abundance. So it's like a formula put together so that folks can learn to rotate among their paddocks within their large pastures or smaller units and keep rotating the animals every two or three days among those paddocks until you keep the grass generally from 8 to 10 inches tall down to 3 inches. You utilize the 8 to 3 inches and then move your animals to another paddock that has 8 inches. That's basically the crux of the of pasture management. But in doing so, there be at least 1.5 to 2 times the amount of grass produced that's useful to your animals versus an open continuous grazing type operation. So it's a way of managing and getting the most out of the land and the, actually to improve the grass stand and the soil underneath it.
Mick, pastured poultry is also a type of livestock that is on raised on grass. And how is pastured poultry different from, say, grass-fed beef?
Well, we talked briefly about it a while ago that the chicken's stomach is such that they can't digest the grass as well as the ruminant animals. So there is a bit of grain that needs to be fed to the animals. But as they're on grass, they can utilize up to 30% of their diet can be from the grass. And they also enjoy the bugs and the insects out there that actually help make the eggs a higher protein. The there are two types of pastured poultry. One of them is egg production, of course, and the other one is for meat production. The meat production is a fairly quick operation, and they usually have movable pens. They move about the pasture and so that they won't tromp the grass out or pull the grass all out in one spot. So they keep moving a pen around, and they go across the pasture, and then at the end of the pasture, they're generally after 8 weeks or 10 weeks or so, they can harvest the meat animals. Now, the egg production is usually they have a movable laying house or a chicken house that is on wheels that they move about and gather the eggs from around the pasture as well. They move the pens around the pasture as well, but they stay on the grass for the full growing season. And the eggs are higher in the omega-3s and conjugated linoleic acid and vitamin A and also vitamin E. So they're really good eggs. And if you've compared one egg from the supermarket to a pastured poultry egg, you'll notice the difference right away. It's a thicker, richer yolk that's darker in color and indicates that the nutrients are much higher.
One of the farmers that we interviewed for this show is practicing a multi-species rotational grazing. So can you just talk a little bit about how having chickens in your multi-species operation is beneficial to the plan overall?
Sure. It's a natural type operation where the livestock will move through the pastures and the chickens will follow. The chickens are notorious or famous, infamous, or whatever word fits best there, for picking up parasites from the leavings behind of the ruminant animals and thereby reducing the worm load and the fly populations in a herd of livestock that you normally have a lot of trouble with. it's a good system where it's symbiotic, and it's also helps with the raising of the chickens as well as the raising of the ruminant animals that they're following. Not to plug any books or any authors or anything like that, but Joe Robinson has written a book that seemed to set a lot of this in motion, this grass-fed industry in motion. And she summarized the health benefits and the benefits to the soil and the land and the consumer. And it's called Why Grass-Fed is Best. And it's a nice little book. It doesn't take long to read it, but it does change your life if you look at it. Grass-fed is the thing of the future as far as how we gather our protein and how we help sustain our land and help keep our communities prosperous and healthy.
And Joe Robinson's website is eatwild.com, right? Okay, so if folks wanted to just look right now, they could check out www.eatwild.com to learn more about the benefits of grass-fed.
So one way that people can support the continuance of our rural landscape, if they care about the rural landscape, is to purchase locally grown grass-fed meat and pastured animals?
That's right. It's all part of the chain, and we hope to be able to sustain our communities and our open lands and the people that are on and of the land by helping to support them in whatever way we can. And the first and the most logical method of doing that is to buy their product. You'll be healthier, the land will be healthier, and your community will be healthier if that's the case. And we keep it in the structure sound and operating that way.
Well, thank you very much, Mick.
You're listening to Living Lightly on the Land, and I'm your host, Liz Lo-Judas. We just heard a little bit of Chet Atkins, and before that, we had an interview with Mick Bessier, who is the ag agent for Cornell Cooperative Extension in Greene and Columbia counties. And our next interview features Erin Myra, our intern from SUNY Cobleskill, and she's talking with grass farmer Jimmy Bulich.
Mail route takes me to within a mile of my West Mountain home. It is my great good fortune to deliver mail to my neighbors. Tim Lippert is one such neighbor who has subsequently become a good friend. He is out doing farm chores as I pull up to his box. Hey Barb, could you bring my chicks out?
Hi, this is Erin Myra from the Greene County Cornell.
It's obvious when a small post office gets in a shipment of chicks. Hatchery boxes are surprisingly small, but the sound that emanates from them is loud. They're not in yet, I tell him. They'll probably come tomorrow. Every rural post office goes through cycles. In late March and early April, we handle all kinds of live things in preparation for our brief yet bountiful growing season. Lots of shoebox-sized parcels come in with silver dollar-sized holes cut into the sides. These contain starter roots and summer bulbs. The most notable seasonal shipment is live chicks. As a chicken lover, hatchery orders are a favorite. Generally, day-old chicks ship in increments of 25. In order to preserve precious body heat, all fit snugly into a box about 12 inches square by 4 inches high. Newborn chicks travel surprisingly well as the remains of their yolk sacs keep them adequately nourished until placed in their new home. This journey's not cushy, though. Frequent peeping is an alert that the baby chicks are chilled. It is imperative that they be kept away from drafts. This brings to mind a tale. Late last March, a very large shipment of baby chicks came into our post office. These boxes are approximately 25 inches square by 6 inches high, roughly quadruple the area of a standard shipping box. Indeed, four standard boxes, each containing 25 live chicks, are nestled together within this large container. This setup helps retain needed heat and keeps the chicks from overcrowding. In their quest to remain warm, baby chicks can pile together tightly enough to suffocate fellow boxmates. That morning, two quad containers came in. Our regular postmaster had scheduled some rare time off, so a woman from a neighboring post office was filling in for him. The day was gray, cold, and blustery. In addition, the building that houses our little post office is small and boxy. When there is a high volume of mail, particularly parcels, organizing and packaging the day's deliveries becomes much like navigating an obstacle course. So, these two large vocal parcels are brought in and parked atop the postmaster's rather small sorting station in an already crowded area. We gather round, wide-eyed and speculative. There's got to be 200 chicks in these boxes, muses a fellow carrier. They are way too many for a backyard flock. These have to be meat birds. I'll bet Franzens are raising broilers, I say. Meanwhile, the insistent little birds have grown increasingly loud. Debbie sets the birds out of a postcon, a large rolling shelf in our small receiving area. While less distracting, the little guys are still peeping away. Then it dawns on me. It is just too cool for the chicks in receiving. Deb, they're really cold out there. They need to be covered up, I say. Debbie, a quiet and gentle woman, goes out, covers the boxes with a couple mail sacks, and the baby chicks settle down considerably. We call our customers when live animals arrive at the post office. It would be far too perilous for them jouncing around in our dusty vehicles with bad shocks. When I got back from my rounds that day, the chicks were gone. France and Scenic Acres and Knox had indeed diversified. They now offer pasture-raised broilers. Back to the present. Again, I pull up to Tim Lippert's mailbox. Tim is owner-operator of Crosby Farm. He's developed a grass-fed beef operation based upon rotational pasturing, and Tim is expanding his offerings. I catch him at chores once more. Barb, they came. Do you want to see my birds? Tim asked. Of course, I answered. I am led to a sheltered area of the barn. Fresh pine shavings are spread on the concrete floor. Warming lights with broad metal shades hang from the ceiling. There are feeding stations with chick starter and fresh water. 200 yellow puffs are scattered about. I put up a draft guard, Tim says, pointing out a length of flexible fencing about 18 inches high. This not only corrals the chicks, but dispels deadly drafts as well. Tim has accounted for all their young needs.
And that was Barbara Bolster Barrett. She was doing a talk about an essay about her experiences as a rural mail carrier. And we're going to start doing listener essays on the show. So if you're interested in sending an essay, you can send it to me at eml37@cornell.edu. And if you'd like to hear more from Barbara, you can read her musings at her blog, which is hilltownbarbwire@wordpress.com. We're going to get back to our interview with Jimmy Bulich in just a minute. But before we do that, I wanted to share a little audio diary with you all. I can relate to Barbara's description of springtime peeping because this time of year, the typical sounds in my neighborhood are those of birds, both domesticated and wild. In the springtime, the cacophony of bird calls rises to a marvelous crescendo as the migrants return north. Their melodic mating songs are sung among crows and cackles of less sophisticated fowl who reside on our farm. My husband and I run a small operation, raising lamb and chicken for home use and sale at a local market. We pasture our animals using intensive rotational grazing methods, which necessitates spending quite a bit of time in the company of sheep and fowl. I find myself listening to fowl, and I must admit that the range of vocalizations made by chickens in their brief lifespan is really quite impressive. I've compiled this audio diary of our pastured poultry operation as a tribute to the sounds of fowl. So take a listen to the sounds of chicks peeping on the first day of their arrival. Notice as their voices begin to mature and you hear the guttural sounds of adult chickens mixing with the peeps. This is how they sound when we move them onto pasture at a few weeks of age when they've gotten their feathers. Then you'll hear the first tentative crows of a young rooster as he tries out his voice. Finally, you'll hear the soothing coos of the chickens as they bed down for the night. Their voices merge with the call of tree frogs in the distance.
Thank you.
And that was a song by Link Ray called Run Chicken Run. And we're going to go ahead and bring you the interview with Aaron Myra and Jimmy Bulich from Pathfinder Farm right now.
Hi, this is Aaron Myra from the Greene County Cornell Cooperative Extension. Today we're interviewing Jimmy Bulich from Pathfinder Farms, located in Catskill, New York. The first question I have for you is, can you please describe your farm for us?
Our farm is a 125-acre former dairy farm. We have 50 acres in mature forest, about 50 acres in pasture, and about 25 acres that is converting to forest. We produce grass-fed beef, sustainable forest products, open space, and wildlife habitat. All of our beef is sold to local families.
What is your philosophy of farming?
Philosophy: organic, natural, seasonal, and sustainable. I've been studying holistic management philosophy, which is developed by Alan Savory, which challenges us to manage our farms in a way that follows nature and strives for improved air, soil, and water quality, and at the same time improved wildlife habitat and improved lifestyles for the farmers, the workers, and the customers who use our product.
Can you define grass-based farming? How does intensive rotational grazing differ from continuous grazing?
Our cattle eat only grass in the pastures during the growing season. And in the wintertime, they eat grass-based forages such as hay or baleage. Our grazing season is from about April through December here. And during that time, we try to put our cattle out on a paddock, a piece of pasture that is enough for them to eat for one day, and then we move them the next day. By moving them the next day, we're able to give the grass time to recover, to regrow its root structure, and to improve not only the health of the grass, but also the health of the soil and the soil life. The grass farmer, which most people who raise grass-fed beef, a lot of folks call themselves grass farmers because that's what they're concentrating on, is producing grass. As a grass farmer, I am striving to improve the pasture with a diverse species of grasses, legumes, and forbs, and increase the organic matter in the soil. And all of this is accomplished through the grazing, by the timing of the grazing and the amount of pasture that we give the cattle each day. On a continuous grazing program, cattle are pretty much left in one area for an extended period of time. Typically, what happens under that scenario is that cattle will go through and they will pick and to eat they like the best, and they will avoid other plants that they don't like. Then what happens is, after they've eaten the plant, it takes a few days, the plant will start to grow back, the cattle will go back and regraze the same plant. This happening over a prolonged period of time, what it ends up doing is sapping the energy of the preferred species by continuously eating the plant before it can fully recover from the shock of being eaten. It also, at the same time, you are basically depleting the preferred species. The cattle are avoiding the species that they don't like, which have time to grow, to mature, to make seed. And the long-term implication is that you have a pasture with a very healthy population of undesirable species, which a lot of times you'll see that. You'll see thistles or other occasional grazing. We are trying to eat or trample everything within that little area in one day to set it all back, and then to give it time to fully recover so that those grass species that I'll do like have a chance to fully recover and therefore be available to eat again without damaging the plant.
What breed of cows do you raise, and why are they good for grass-fed, grass-finished production?
Our cattle are commercial Hereford cattle, which means they're Herefords and Hereford crosses. The English breeds, which include Hereford, Angus, Galloway, and Devon, and I might be missing a couple there, are the best suited to grass finishing. Grass finishing means that the cattle are mature enough, they fully develop their body structure, their muscling, and they are old enough now to put on fat, to deposit intramuscular. They're mature enough, and there's plenty of energy in the pasture that they're eating, that are able to finish, to put that marbling on. When conventional cattle are essentially grain finished, what that means is that the last few months of their life, they are given a high grain ration to help put the fat, the marbling.
How do you market your beef?
We sell all our beef to local families. We sell as halves, 25 or 50 pound boxes, or by the piece. We have freezers right here at the farm. Our beef are butchered at a USDA slaughterhouse in Canaan, New York, which is less than an hour away. And beef is all cryovac packaged with labeling, and we pretty much we sell to families the whole range. Like I said, we have people who just come out and buy one steak maybe once a year. We have people who buy a 50-pound box. We still have a few families who will buy a whole half.
What do you hope for the future of your farm and for the land that you manage?
My hope is that our farm can continue as it is right now, that the open areas, the pastures, are managed in a way that they're grazed and they continue to improve. We see an improvement in the species composition, the organic matter in the soil, water retention, the increase in actual volume of forage that the pastures can produce. At the same time, our forests are... We are on the second round of going through and thinning our forest, and what we're seeing is by removing low-quality wood and saving the better trees to reach their potential, that we are seeing an increase not only in value, but an increase in the number of healthy trees that are growing as a percentage. And, you know, when I look at it from a pasture standpoint, and I see our cattle have a lot more to eat, better quality of forage to eat, then I know that the health of the grass is going to translate to the health of the cattle. At the same time, our pastures are habitat for ground nesting birds, food for deer and turkeys. We have all kinds of wildlife that share that same habitat. The same thing happens in the woods. By choosing to let a tree grow and to remove the competition around it to let it reach its potential, we're seeing more. We have oak trees that are producing acorns, hickory trees that are producing hickory nuts. We have killed some trees and let them stand to provide habitat for woodpeckers. We put up bluebird boxes in our fields. So a lot of it is all working together to have your fields and your forest provide food, provide products, and to provide habitat all at the same time. I think we're doing that right now, and that's what I would like to see continue. I also have some numbers here that I keep track of. On our farm, we have seen on this farm 14 mammal species, which does not count mice and moles and stuff like that. So there's could be more than that. We have 42 species of trees and shrubs on our property, and I have seen 69 different species of birds on our property. And that is actually not all there are, because I haven't gotten all the sparrow species or the transient warbler species in that count. So, our little 135-acre parcel is home to not just people and animals and trees, but to our the habitat provides a place for a lot of different species. And so when I say that I'd like to see our farm remain whole, in order for a place like this to continue to see those kinds of numbers, our place needs to remain whole. Some of the places around us need to remain whole. That would be my hope for the future, is that it could continue to be an area that is full of life and at the same time very productive with food, timber, other products. We're looking at the long-term health of the land. As long as the land remains healthy, it can continue to provide for us.
Thank you for your time today. You're listening to Living Lightly on the Land.
And I'm your host, Lislo Judas. We're going to go right into our next interview with Carol Clement. Carol and her husband, John Harrison, run Heather Ridge Farm in Preston Hollow. And Carol talked with us about her philosophy of farming during this recent interview. Well, that was actually some spring peepers and tree frogs. We have a ghost in the machine, but we're going to go ahead and bring you the interview with Carol from Heather Ridge Farm.
Today we're interviewing Carol Clement from Heather Ridge Farm, located in Preston Hollow, New York. Can you please describe your farm for us?
Well, this is an old dairy farm on a hill, and we have great southern exposure, great views of the Catskill Mountains, poor soil, but for me it's the center of the universe. We've been able to raise a real diversified type of livestock. So many different things going on here. My husband says, there's always something going on at Heather Ridge. We have cattle, we have pigs, we have sheep, we have goats, we have chickens, we have turkeys. We have a farm store, we have a cafe. So we keep ourselves quite busy.
Can you please describe your philosophy of farming?
When we first started, and it was about 8 years ago that we decided to make the farm full-time, we took some holistic management classes, and you have to really put down a mission statement and boil down your ideas. And we decided the most important thing to us was that we were going to leave this place in better shape than when we found it. And sort of everything stems from that. We're really trying to improve the land, do the best we can raising the animals, give them the best life possible, create the best food that we can, and hopefully we get a lot of joy out of that and hopefully make a living.
You practice intensive rotational grazing with many species of animals. Please describe your pasture-based system of farming, including the different rotational livestock, how each livestock species is rotated.
This is a fabulous system. I actually got introduced to it before I was a farmer. I did a lot of marketing and video production, and I was hired to do a videotape by the Catskill Center on rotational grazing. This was back in the early 90s. A lot of the dairy farms had sold their cows in the federal buyout program in the late 80s, and the ones that were left were struggling to hang on. A few had gone to rotational grazing and were finding great gains because of it. So I went and interviewed these farmers who were doing rotational grazing on their dairy farms, and I got so turned on to it. I realized that you didn't have to have a giant tractor and silos and barns and all this stuff to get into farming. I had wanted to get into farming, but never thought it was practical because of the capital investment that have to be put into it. So I just got totally turned on, and it was a few years after that I said to my husband, let's farm. Let's make it full time. We can do this. So we started doing it here. These fields had never been grazed that way before. It was just set grazing where a whole bunch of cows would be put out in the field and till the grass was eaten down, and then they would be moved to another field. But we take the animals and just put them on a, look at the number of animals, look at the length of the grass, put the animals on it for a certain amount of time and move them. The cattle get moved every day. The sheep and the goats get moved every other day. The chickens get moved every day. So there's a lot of labor involved, but they are, through their moving around, they're harvesting their own food, they're spreading their own shit. We have no tractor on this farm. Of course, if you saw how steep the hills were, you'd understand we don't want a tractor on this farm. We would probably kill ourselves. But we hire a tractor a half a day a year to do some work for us, and the rest of it is all done by the animals. By doing the animals through succession, we usually have the cattle go through different sections of different paddocks in the different fields, then let the grass grow back to a certain stage, have the sheep go through. They're followed by the layers and the meat birds, and by having that mix of rotation, you're actually doing a great job of fertilizing the land thoroughly. The chickens pull apart the cow patties and spread them. You cut down your amount of parasites, because the following animal eating the grass, which may have some parasites from the source species, get rid of those parasites but don't get them themselves because they're species specific. So you end up with healthier animals and healthier fields in a short amount of time. It just took a few years to take some really scrubby, bad, overused fields and turn them into some really lush working pastures. And we don't have very thick topsoil. We're on the top of the mountain here. It's a veneer of soil that we have. But we're able to get a great pasture crop out of it and really have animals that thrive on it.
How many acres do you have in rotational grazing total?
It's actually a small part of the farm. We have about 15 or so acres enclosed in high tensile fencing where we keep our cattle, some of the yearling sheep and goats, and the birds. We do an additional probably 50 acres where we put the sheep and goat moms and babies through in a different area.
You also raise honeybees. Is there any way that bees and other pollinators benefit from a grass-based system?
I think they're integrally locked together. For me, it works the other way around. The bees really help the pasture system. I've actually given a couple of small talks. They only last a few minutes on how... when you have a pasture, ours are all native grasses. We've never planted any grasses. And you want to encourage legumes to grow, clovers, alfalfas, things like that, so which are higher protein. They pull minerals up deeper from the soil. And what pollinates those but honeybees? And so if you want to strengthen your pastures, you should have honeybees. I think farms used to all have a couple of beehives, not just for the honey and the wax, but for general pollination. And it wasn't just apple trees is what people think about. It's really those legumes in the field that make the biggest difference on whether it's a dairy farm or any kind of livestock farm. And I've done a lot of research on this, because if you're a beekeeper, they tell you that bees don't pollinate red clover. I said, that can't be. I see bees on the red clover all the time. So I found out that this works in beautifully with rotational grazing. When the red clover first comes out, it's a very large blossom, and it's hard for the honeybees, generally bumblebees, go to it. But when you cut it down the second growth, the blossom is smaller, and the honeybees go crazy for it. It works perfectly in rotational grazing. The animals go through, eat the first layer down. That clover pops right back up, gives a smaller plant. So your bees are strengthening. By pollinating your clovers and alfalfas, they're strengthening the legumes in your field, which is improving the quality of the forage for the animals. And you have these nice fields with this stuff that is food for the bees, so they work hand-in-hand with improving each other.
Do you raise any other products in addition to meat and honey?
Those are the, well, meat, red meat, white meat, chickens. We used to raise a lot of garlic But I convinced my neighbors to raise it for me, so they're doing it now. We do have a small garden where we raise some of the vegetables and herbs for using in the cafe here, but much of that we buy from other local farms. We make a lot of products, secondary products, from those items. We make our own sausages in our licensed kitchen. We can make corned beef and things like that. We run a whole cafe. From the sheep and llama wool, we have socks made. We make soaps and honey with the soaps and candles with the beeswax and honey. So we have a lot of secondary products like that that come out of the basic meat and honey slot.
How do you market your products?
Most of our sales are right here on the farm. I think we're really lucky that we have a pretty spot. And we've tried to make it a destination for people to come. So people can come, and this is the original 1820s farmhouse on the farm. Come here. It's set up like a store. We added a cafe 2 years ago, so people can come, have lunch, shop, hang out for a while. This year we're adding walking trails and regular farm tours, so people can really make it a destination, bring their friends, bring their kids, and hang out for a while. We were finding that people would come. We're in the middle of nowhere. You know, we're centrally isolated. And people would come, buy their stuff, and they would come from a half hour, an hour away, and they'd hem and haw and hang around and want to talk and talk to other people. So we decided to give them a way to be comfortable and socialize. And so doing the cafe and building on that has been a real positive thing for us, and people seem to like it.
What are your future plans for the farm in your lifetime and beyond?
We're really concentrating now on making the farm more efficient, both efficient in terms of our own work and in energy use. You know, we're looking into what alternative power systems we can put in here, and also what simple things we can do just to make everyday life and chores easier on us. What happens in the long run is a real issue that we're grappling with. We have no kids, and if you do have kids, often they're not interested in farming anyway. We do have friends that successfully had the model of as they aged, they had a younger couple come and buy into the farm. They spent like a 5-year transition showing them everything they knew about running the farm. The new couple built a separate house on the farm. The older couple kept their own home and lived on the farm and phased themselves out of actively working on it and out of the ownership of the rest of the farm, just keeping their house. And there were a couple bumps along the way, but it worked out to be a very good transition for the younger couple to be able to acquire a farm and a working farm and a real head start and then move it in their own direction. And for the older couple to get their investment out of the farm, still live in the environment they want, and pass on what they had learned. And so that all their efforts weren't for naught. And I'd love to, anybody out there who wants to consider something like that, we're not quite ready to hang it up, but we do think about that. You know, it's an incredible personal investment of time and energy and passion to make something like this work. And you want someone to continue it in some way. Who has that same kind of commitment. And so we would be open to something like that.
How can people learn more about Heather Ridge Farm?
We're open to the public. People can come and visit. We have a very good website that I try hard to keep up to date, which really gives you a good introduction to the farm and the schedule of what's going on. You know, we'll be putting up the schedule of the farm tours as they're set. Starting Memorial Day weekend, we're planned to be open both Saturday and Sunday, so people can just drop by, and no commitment necessary, and to see what we're like, take a walk on the trails, have lunch or not, try buying. You know, since we run more like a store, you can buy just a dozen eggs or a pound of ground beef, or you know, try a couple things and see if you like it, and then go on your way. And if you really like it, you can come back and buy a lot.
Thank you very much for your time today and answering our questions.
My pleasure.
So that's it for our show today. If you'd like to learn more about where to find grass-fed meats, give us a call at 518-622-9820.